time to open up the Bordeaux. I'm going to lean back and put my feet up. Calls out to wife in another room. Darling, I've decided to become a hedonist. I'm sipping a nice glass of wine by the fire, nibbling on brie, and listening to Moonlight Sonata. To make things absolutely perfect, I'm going to need you to come in here and give me a foot massage. Wife calls back. Yeah, fat chance, buddy. Time to take out the garbage. Skeptic. You know, maybe this hedonism thing isn't going to work out. Maybe those psychologists who say that chasing after happiness will only lead to unhappiness were right. Answer. If you spend your life chasing sensual pleasures or avoiding any activity that frightens you, those psychologists are definitely right. That won't make you happy. Better to take the advice of Democritus, the ancient Greek philosopher most famous for originating the theory that the universe consisted of atoms. His contemporaries called him the laughing philosopher because he advocated living a cheerful life. While it is true that he loved the occasional drunken bacchanal, he thought that the most pleasure came from a serene, internal state of mind, a pleasant disposition that one carefully cultivated. You too can cultivate such a disposition. We will do this by taking a systems thinking approach to the human body, called biohacking. We are biological machines, and there is no reason we can't hack nature's design and reconfigure it to make us feel spectacular. Professional athletes already do this for sport. They are continually searching for an advantage by studying the science of exercise physiology, biomechanics, and the art of injecting illicit chemical compounds into their rear ends. They use this knowledge to train their bodies to reach peak performance. If we can break down the mechanics of the human body to improve athletic performance, why can't we do the same for our well-being? Once we understand the how and why of happiness, we can take our cue from these athletes, train our minds, and achieve optimal well-being. Evolutionary fitness and happiness. Evolutionary fitness is our ability to pass on our genes, taking into account both natural and sexual selection. These genes developed a signal, a sense of well-being, to reward our ancestors for behaving in ways that led to evolutionary fitness. But the genes also punished our ancestors with stress signals when they were acting in ways harmful to the genes' ability to self-replicate. To figure out how to achieve well-being, we need to know exactly what our genes like and don't like. The problem is the environment we live in today is different from the environment in which the signals originally evolved. Our signals are all out of whack. To solve the riddle of human happiness, we have to study the people who live in this ancient way. What we'll find will cause you to reevaluate everything you thought you knew about health and happiness. 2. Happy Tribes. Pygmies. Of all the mysteries of Africa, none is more fascinating than the saga of the nation of tiny people who live hidden away deep within its dense rainforests. The earliest record of their existence comes from the correspondence of the 8-year-old Egyptian pharaoh Pepe II, throne name Neferkare, around 2250 BCE. After receiving word from Harkuf, one of his governors, that amongst the bounteous treasures found in their expeditions to the south was a dancing dwarf, the young pharaoh could hardly contain his excitement. He writes, "I have noted your letter, which you have sent in order that the king might know that you descended in safety from Yam with the army which was with you. You have said in this letter that you have brought a dancing dwarf of the god from the land of spirits. Come northward to the court immediately. You shall bring this dwarf with you, which thou bringest living and healthy from the land of spirits, for the dances of the god, to gladden the heart of the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Neferkare, who lives forever. When he goes down with you into the vessel, appoint excellent people, who shall be beside him on each side of the vessel. Take care lest he fall into the water. When he sleeps at night, appoint excellent people, who shall sleep beside him in his tent. My Majesty desires to see this dwarf more than the gifts of Sinai and Punt. If thou arrivest at court with this dwarf being alive, prosperous, and healthy, My Majesty will do for thee a greater thing than which was done for the treasurer of the god Berded in the time of Isis, according to the heart's desire of My Majesty to see the dwarf. Outside of Africa, stories of these tiny people gained a mythical status. In the Iliad, Homer writes of cranes who fly south during the winter to attack and kill pygmy nations. Where Homer got the idea that pygmies engaged in life-or-death battle with large murderous birds is a mystery, but the story was widespread. Pottery, dating back to 424 BCE, shows pygmies in mortal combat with these giant cranes. The great philosopher Aristotle, a bit more skeptical perhaps, omitted the crane-pygmy war in his book, History of Animals. The storks pass from the plains of Scythia to the marsh of Upper Egypt, towards the sources of the Nile. This is the district in which the pygmies inhabit, whose existence is not a fable. There really is, as men say, a species of men of little stature, and their horses are little also. They pass their life in caverns. But a few centuries later, the famous Greek historian Pliny the Elder favored Homer's view of the pygmies. Beyond these, in the most outlying mountain region, we are told of the three-span pygmy, who do not exceed three spans, that is, 27 inches in height. The climate is healthy and always spring-like, as it is protected on the north by a range of mountains. This tribe Homer has also recorded as being at war with cranes. It is reported that in springtime, their entire band, mounted on the backs of rams and she-goats armed with arrows, goes in a body down to the sea and eats the cranes' eggs and chickens, and that this outing occupies 3 months, and that otherwise they could not protect themselves against the flocks of cranes who would grow up, and that their houses are made of mud and feathers and eggshell. Clearly, the ancient world suffered from a shortage of reliable testimony regarding the lives of these mysterious pygmies. But early attempts at gathering empirical evidence often proved fatal. An Arab slave trader from the 1st century BCE, by the name of Abed bin Juma, became entranced by the stories he heard of these dwarf people. He marched his caravan through the treacherous jungles of present-day Zaire in hopes of encountering the pygmies. When he finally found them, he reported being fiercely received by the malicious little demons who sprang from the soil like mushrooms and showered their poisoned arrows on the travelers. Nearly 2,000 years later, the mythical status of the pygmies had hardly diminished. The early European explorers of Africa were told incredible stories by non-pygmy African tribes of dwarf people with tails who were excellent elephant hunters due to their extraordinary power to make themselves invisible. When the white man and the pygmies finally did meet, the previous hostility exhibited by the pygmies toward outsiders proved justified. The explorers treated the pygmies like animals. The early 19th century explorers captured the pygmy children and transported them to zoos all across Europe. Even the United States participated in these horrific acts. In 1906, the Bronx Zoo placed a pygmy from the Mabuti tribe named Otto Bingo in the monkey house, along with the other primates. He shot his bows and arrows and showed off his pointed teeth, filed into sharp fangs as was the custom in his tribe, to the adoring crowds. People came by the thousands to see him. The newspapers reported that he would get into wild wrestling matches with an orangutan and establish dominion over the other primates, speaking to them in his native guttural tongue, which they seemed to understand. Anthropologists have since come a long way in their understanding of pygmies, who are now defined as an ethnic group in which the height of adult males is on average less than 4 feet 11 inches tall. And while they may not have the magical powers once ascribed to them, the story I will tell of the pygmies is no less astonishing than the tall, or should I say short, tales told to outsiders of the pygmy people. For the pygmies hold the answer to the greatest question ever posed by mankind. The Secret of How to Find Happiness. Many different groups of pygmies exist today, with as many as 500,000 living in the Central African rainforest. When John Lennon wrote Imagine, he might easily have been describing traditional African pygmy society. The pygmies have few possessions, and no one is described as either rich or poor. They pay no taxes, have no laws, and everything is shared. Polygamous and monogamous behavior are both accepted. They work half as much as we do and have an abundance of leisure time. Pygmies don't slave away all day at dreary, repetitive jobs to raise cash to buy more stuff they don't need. Pygmies do something a tad more thrilling than navigating a shopping cart through a supermarket aisle. They hunt wild animals using nets, spears, bows, and arrows. Small prey, like the tiny forest antelope, run too quickly to chase after on foot, so the pygmies surround the antelope and flush it out, eventually catching it with a net before pouncing on it and quickly killing it. Every once in a while, the pygmies will hunt much larger and more dangerous game. Elephants. To hunt an elephant, the pygmy will track the elephant's large tracks through the jungle. He will paint his face black so that if he is spotted by his prey, the elephant will think he is a monkey. The pygmy will sneak up on the elephant and jam a spear into its belly, then turn around and sprint back through the forest. The elephant will slowly bleed to death. The pygmy merely has to follow the increasingly bloody trail until the elephant eventually collapses. Upon the death of the elephant, a great feast is held, and neighboring tribes from all around the region will gather to celebrate. Festivities include dancing, singing, and lovemaking, as people rejoice because the forest has provided them with enough meat to last a long time. Anthropologist Kevin Duffy spent time living with the Mbuti pygmies, and it is to his excellent work, Children of the Forest, that I am most indebted. This is how he describes a day in the life of the pygmies. What do the Mbuti do when they don't have to hunt and gather? Plenty. But first, there are always the routine chores that make a camp function. Collecting firewood, fetching water, cooking the morning meal, and tending the children. Yet, with a sheer exuberance and joy of living that I have seen only among the Mbuti, there were also spontaneous dances and singing, adding to the sounds of a happy camp. At the forest's edge, laughing children were swinging from a hanging vine 100 feet long, while nearby girls were acrobatically skipping rope, using a length of liana with the greatest dexterity. Compared to the practices of the pygmies, sex in the 21st century seems downright puritanical. The pygmies' amorous adventures begin at an early age. The moment they hit puberty, the Mbuti begin to engage in daily sex with many different members of the tribe. This period of free love lasts for a year or so before they get married and start having children. Strangest of all is the courtship Duffy himself engaged in with a pygmy woman named Alita. She was the smallest girl in the camp, standing under 4 feet tall. Alita also had a problem. She was related to everyone else in the camp. While sleeping with cousins is all good fun, and the pygmies consider it a natural part of growing up, a pygmy is forbidden to marry a relative. This left our 5'10" white anthropologist as the only available bachelor living in the camp, and Alita had her eyes on him. Alita's cousin, Sukali, acted as matchmaker. He led Duffy to a river stream where Alita and Sukali's wife were bathing naked. When they arrived, Sukali grabbed his wife and they ran into the forest for some spontaneous lovemaking, leaving Duffy and Alita alone. Perhaps he can be forgiven for not being around any normal-sized women in a while, but I still find his attraction for the yardstick-high Alita very curious, especially the glowing terms in which he describes their flirtation, a tit-for-tat that he was apparently losing. As he writes, I was beginning to feel that I had lost command of the situation to this tiny girl-woman, this miniature Venus, who had risen lovely and flower-like from the spring with drops of water glistening on the petals of her golden body. Deciding to be a gentleman, at least for the moment, he did not sleep with his aboriginal Thumbelina right then. Instead, they walked back to camp, but not before running into Sukali and his wife having sex on the mossy floor. They paid little notice to Duffy, even though he nearly stumbled over them. Ever the dutiful anthropologist, Duffy noted to himself that the pygmies were not copulating in the missionary position. Later that night, during a torrential downpour, Duffy was alone in his hut when the tiny, muddy-footed Alita came in to sleep with him. After teasing us with a chapter of lightweight erotica, Duffy skips over the best part, leaving out the juicy details. How in the world did he physically have sex with a 3-foot-tall pygmy girl? How did she feel about sleeping with a giant? What position were they in when the deed was done? What was their pillow talk like? These are things the anthropological record simply demands. Instead, Duffy plays coy, saying only that from that night onward, he never had to do his own cooking and housework again. More than their laissez-faire attitude towards sex and their intriguing way of obtaining food, the pygmies have a zest for life, which is always bubbling up to the surface and can explode into song and dance at any moment. The joie de vivre can be attributed to their oneness with their natural environment and their lack of concern for the future or interest in the past. The pygmies are as well adapted to their environment as any other species that resides in the forest with them. Their way of life has never driven a single species of plant or animal into extinction. They look upon the forest as their parent and consider themselves the children of the forest. The forest is a sacred place, much like a mosque or a temple, except that this holy land is a living, breathing entity filled with exotic wildlife. Underneath the canopy of tall trees reside majestic, rarely seen animals like the okapi, an 8-foot-tall relative of the giraffe, with a beautiful dark brown coat covering its midsection and black and white zebra stripes running down its legs. In the land of the pygmy, giant hogs and colorful peacocks coexist with boisterous chimpanzees. The sounds of the forest range from a peaceful silence to the howling of monkeys to a cacophony of songs from birds and crickets. In the Ituri forest, where most pygmies live, the temperature rarely drops below 72 degrees, and humidity is usually 100%. The only clothing the pygmies wear is a G-string woven from tree fibers. No one is self-conscious about being naked. For shelter, they build small huts out of nearby sticks and leaves. These huts look like green igloos, with only a tiny opening one crawls through to enter. Pygmies do not worry about what will happen to them in the weeks, months, and years to come, as they trust that the forest will provide all they need to live, just as the forest always has. Duffy writes, "To the Mabuti, the past is unimportant because it is gone completely and forever. As for the future, they have little desire to control what does not yet exist. The present is something that happens every day, and is to be enjoyed with consideration for others, with love, and sometimes with passion. The Mabuti's natural and total harmony with their ecosystem is something from which all people can learn. And we should remember them well, for the Mabuti mirror our past. They are the living spirits of our not-so-distant hunting and gathering ancestors." Anthropologist Colin Turnbull agrees. He says, "The Mabuti pygmies were a people who had found in the forest something that made their life more than just worth living, something that made it, with all its hardships and problems and tragedies, a wonderful thing full of joy and happiness and free of care." Echoing these statements, anthropologist Paul Scabesta writes of the same pygmies, "The pygmies stand before us as one of the most natural of human races, as people who live exclusively in compliance with nature and without violation of their physical organism. Among their principal traits are an unusually sturdy naturalness and liveliness, and an unparalleled cheerfulness and freedom from care. They are people whose lives pass in compliance with the laws of nature." The mystery of the pygmy people continues into the new century. scientists still debate the cause of their short stature. Some believe their diminutive size allows them to be nimble and quick as they scamper through the dense rainforests. Recent theories suggest that their small height can be attributed to their shorter lifespans. Pygmies rarely live much longer than 40 years, but this is not necessarily due to their harsh environment or some illness, but rather to the speed with which they reach reproductive age. Pygmy children develop much quicker than normal children, and by the age of 2 are already expert archers, who can hunt small game within a year or two. Pygmy girls start taking care of younger children by age 6. In fact, pygmy children and normal children grow at about the same rate, but the pygmy will stop growing by the age of 12, having reached his full height of around 4 feet. By the age of 20, a pygmy woman will have already had several children and will appear middle-aged. A great tragedy has overcome many of the African pygmies in recent years, as their hunter-gatherer way of life has been menaced. Today, many are forced to work as slave laborers for their taller neighbors. Yet, in other parts of the world, their mythology continues to grow. In March 2013, rangers from the Wai Kambas National Park in Indonesia claimed to have spotted dozens of naked pygmies no more than 20 inches tall, sporting dreadlocks down to their waist. Do these miniature people really exist in the dense forest of the park? While the enigma of the pygmies continues to baffle us, what we do know is that their hunter-gatherer lifestyle and their intimate bond with their natural surroundings has led them to a happiness unknown to modern society. New World Savages. Some time ago, perhaps 15,000 years in the past, the megafauna, also known as the comically large animals of Siberia, decided that they had more than enough of that desolate place, and chose to make a break for greener pastures. When you are a human being living in Siberia, and your survival depends on eating woolly mammoths and mastodons, and these gigantic elephant-like creatures suddenly decide they want you to get out of Dodge, you have little choice but to pick up your spear and follow them. This is how the first Paleo-Indians came to occupy the great North American continent. They followed these enormous beasts across a land and ice bridge that once connected Siberia and Alaska. This area is now known as the Bering Strait. The nomads then followed the newly opened coastline, thanks to the vanishing ice age, and headed south and eventually east. These regions, uninhabited by people, abounded with bison and other wild game, and in a relatively short period of time, millions of humans were flourishing in North and South America. Thousands of years later, explorers from a far-off land would cross the ocean and pay them a visit. These sailors came from a culture that had been practicing agriculture and living in large cities for over 10,000 years. They had completely forgotten the old, natural way of life that humans had pursued since the dawn of man. It is this collision between such vastly different societies and a world still filled with mystery and wonder that so fascinates us. Every American child knows the story of Christopher Columbus sailing with the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria from the shores of Spain to the Caribbean. As adults, we learn that Columbus was a profoundly flawed human being, but few of us ever hear the story of the beautiful people Columbus stumbled upon on those isles. Columbus describes the natives he met in the first letter that he wrote about his voyage. "The inhabitants of both sexes of this and of all the other islands I have seen, or of which I have any knowledge, always go as naked as they came into the world, except that some of the women cover their private parts with leaves or branches, or a veil of cotton, which they prepare themselves for this purpose. Their bodies are well made. They are very guileless and honest, and very liberal of all they have. No one refuses the asker anything that he possesses. On the contrary, they themselves invite us to ask for it. They manifest the greatest affection towards all of us, exchanging valuable things for trifles, content with the very least thing or nothing at all. They are neither lazy nor awkward, but on the contrary, are of an excellent and acute understanding. Those who have sailed these seas give excellent accounts of everything, but they have never seen men wearing clothes or ships like ours. Columbus said that he had to put a stop to the unfair trading his sailors engaged in. In his eyes, trading iron nails for large pieces of gold was unjust. Of course, in the very next paragraph, Columbus boasts that with 50 men he could subjugate the entire island and bring back as many servants and slaves as the king desired. A complex man, Columbus. The Spanish subjugation of the Caribbean natives in the name of gold, God, and glory in the years to come was horrifying. Needing gold to pay back the money invested in their expeditions, the Spaniards enslaved the Indians and forced them to work in mines. When no gold was found, the Spaniards took their Indian slaves back to Europe. They killed without conscience or mercy. The conquistadors even tested out the sharpness of their swords by slicing up innocent Indians. It was genocide. A fascinating and brutal history, but one I shall pass over, as it takes us away from our main concern. The lives of these supposedly primitive Indians before the Spanish conquest. For that, we gain more insight from Amerigo Vespucci, who reputedly traveled on 4 expeditions to South America a few years after Columbus. Whether he went on the 1st and 4th voyages is widely disputed, but the middle 2 definitely happened. On his 2nd voyage, Vespucci writes that upon seeing the Spanish ships for the first time, the South American natives jumped into their canoes and paddled out to meet them. But the Spaniards had other plans. They wanted to take them captive. So when the canoes got close enough, they bore down on the natives with their ship in hopes of capsizing the canoes and taking them prisoner. The natives abandoned their canoes and swam 6 miles safely to shore. Vespucci noted that the Indians were far faster runners and much better swimmers than the Christians. When the Europeans reached the mainland, they spent about 3 weeks exploring and were altogether friendly with the natives they found. Curious natives came every day from farther inland to marvel at their boats and white skin. Leaving the mainland, the Europeans set sail to explore other parts of the New World, reaching a small island off the coast. On this island, they found human footprints of colossal size. Anxious to see what sort of people could possibly have such large feet, they trekked off into the valley, eventually coming upon some huts. There they found 2 old women and 3 young girls. All of them were enormous. Vespucci, for whom the American continents are named, says, "The children were of such lofty stature that, for the wonder of the thing, we wanted to keep them." The Europeans planned to kidnap the frightened, abnormally tall young girls and bring them back to Castile. Their plans were foiled when, as many as 36 men, much bigger than the women, and so well made that it was a rare thing to behold them, showed up brandishing spears. Vespucci and his companions decided to saunter back out of the village and make their way back to the ships, acting as if nothing had happened. In a 1502 letter attributed to him, describing his 3rd voyage, Vespucci tells much more about the natives and their way of life. "We found the region inhabited by a race of people who were entirely naked, both men and women. They have large, square-built bodies and well-proportioned. Their color reddish, which I think is caused by their going naked and exposed to the sun. Their hair is plentiful and black. They are agile in walking and of quick sight. They are of a free and good-looking expression of countenance. They have no laws and no religious belief, but live according to the dictates of nature alone. They know nothing of the immortality of the soul. They have no private property, but everything in common. They have no boundaries of kingdom or province. They obey no king or lord, for it is wholly unnecessary, as they have no laws, and each one is his own master." So far so good. But then things take a rather strange turn. After describing the odd facial piercing habits of the natives, Vespucci says, "The women, as I have said, go naked, and are very libidinous, yet their bodies are comely. but they are as wild as can be imagined. They make the penis of their husbands swell to such a size as to appear deformed, and this is accomplished by a certain artifice, being the bite of some poisonous animal. And by reason of this, many lose their virile organ and remain eunuchs. Clearly, primitive life was not superior to the modern version in all ways. As much as I enjoy the company of seductive, resourceful women, I am quite content with modern foreplay bereft of venomous creatures. Vespucci also wrote that the natives rarely got sick, lived to be 150 years old, and were surprised that Europeans didn't eat their enemies, given that the taste of human flesh is quite excellent. Despite Vespucci's obvious exaggerations, the news of the natives' cannibalism spread throughout Europe, and the populace soon thought of them as savages. These were creatures who ran around naked, lived without law and order, and ceremoniously ate the corpses of those they had bested in war. Brutal savages they must be. The great 16th century philosopher, Michel de Montaigne, became fascinated by the discoveries being made in the New World. He spent time with the explorers and interviewed the Brazilian natives they brought back to France. He found them to be just as perplexed by European society as the Europeans were perplexed by theirs. They could not understand, for instance, why such large, armed, and bearded men, the king's guard, would allow themselves to be bossed around by a child, the 13-year-old King Charles IX. Or, more poignantly, how there could be such a large disparity of wealth between those with castles and servants and all sorts of riches, while outside their doors were beggars, emaciated and hungry. Antonia came to a more enlightened conclusion regarding their barbarism. In his essay, Of Cannibals, he writes, "These nations seem to me, then, barbaric in that they have been little refashioned by the human mind and are still quite close to their original simplicity. They are still ruled by natural laws, only slightly corrupted by ours. They are in such a state of purity that I am sometimes saddened by the thought that we did not discover them earlier, when there were people who would have known how to judge them better than we. It displeases me that Lycurgus or Plato didn't know them, for it seems to me that these peoples surpass not only the portraits which poetry has made of the Golden Age and all the invented, imaginary notions of the ideal state of humanity, but even the conceptions and the very aims of philosophers themselves. They could not imagine such a pure and simple nature as we encounter in them, nor would they have been able to believe that our society might be maintained with so little artifice and social structure. This is a people, I would say to Plato, among whom there is no commerce at all, no knowledge of letters, no knowledge of numbers, nor any judges or political superiority, no habit of service, riches, or poverty, no contracts, no inheritance, no divisions of property, no occupations but easy ones, no respect for any relationship except ordinary family ones, no clothes, no agriculture, no metal, no use of wine or wheat. The very words which mean lie, treason, deception, greed, envy, slander, and forgiveness are unknown. How far his imaginary republic would be from such perfection." Benjamin Franklin was a wise and intelligent man who admired the natives of the New World. He wrote about the extraordinary quality of life, nobility, and civility of these people, still commonly referred to by his countrymen as savages. The Indians were generally seen by the North American settlers, most of them hard-working Protestants, as being poor, ignorant, and uneducated. The Indians had a different view. Franklin writes, "Having few artificial wants, they have abundance of leisure for improvement by conversation. Our laborious manner of life compared with theirs, they esteem slavish and base, and the learning on which we value ourselves, they regard as frivolous and useless." Franklin goes on to tell a story about how the state of Virginia thought it would be a great benefit to the Indians to set up a college fund, so that 6 kids from neighboring tribes could attend a college in Williamsburg. The Indians thought it over for a day and came back with a polite reply. First, they profusely thanked the government of Virginia for making such a kind offer, knowing that the government had the interests of the Indians in mind, and no doubt believed that the kind of learning taught in their colleges was of great value. But this experiment had been tried before, with Indian children going off to school to learn the knowledge of the white man and then returning to the Indian tribes completely useless, saying that they were bad runners, ignorant of every means of living in the woods, could not withstand the heat or cold, knew nothing of how to hunt or build a cabin, spoke our language imperfectly, they were totally good for nothing. Franklin had other things to say about the happiness and tranquility of Indian life. He couldn't help noticing that while Indians seemed disinclined to ditch their culture for the Euro-American one, many Euro-Americans were more than willing to become Indians. Franklin supplied this example. He had heard of a person who had been captured by the Indians, lived with them for a few years, and was later rescued by his own people. He returned home to a sizable estate. Wealthy, free from care, back among friends, this man would surely want to remain in civilized society, right? Wrong. Before long, he grew tired of the effort needed to maintain such a lifestyle, turned his estate over to his younger brother, and, taking only a rifle and a match coat, took his way again to the wilderness. Franklin used this story to illustrate his point that no European who has tasted savage life can afterwards bear to live in our societies. Such societies, wrote Franklin, provided their members with greater opportunities for happiness than European cultures. Cannibals of the South Pacific. Starving, freezing from a torrential downpour, and lost in the jungle of a tropical island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, Herman Melville saw his first sign of human life in many days. A well-beaten path leading to a remote village of tiki huts and loincloth-wearing natives. Of the two main tribes that inhabited that island, there were the Hapar, known for being friendly and cordial, and the Taipi, by reputation cannibals who would feast on the Americans' white flesh if given the chance. There was no way of knowing which of the tribes this path led to. While the idea of ending up as someone's dinner wasn't an appealing prospect, Melville, weak and shivering, had no chance of surviving in the jungle without help. Better to take a 50-50 chance at staying alive than a slow and painful death at the hands of Mother Nature. He stepped onto the path. The path led to the Taipi village. Today, Herman Melville is best known as the author of the literary classic Moby Dick. During his life, however, he was known as the man who lived among the cannibals. The tale of his time spent with these savages offers a glimpse into daily human life before the intrusion of the modern world. Melville was filled with wanderlust and had an independent streak from a very young age. Wishing to be free of family support and determined to make a life for himself that included adventure and traveling, the 20-year-old Melville signed up to be a crew member on the Acushnet, a whaling ship that would go on a journey through the Pacific Ocean. 18 months later, sick of the long trip and the unfair treatment he thought the workers received, Melville decided to jump ship while it was docked in the Marquesas Islands of the South Pacific. He and a fellow shipmate made a daring escape from the boat and headed for the hills. Overly confident in their ability to survive in the jungle, they found harsh reality encroaching on them after only a few days. Starving and without reliable shelter to protect themselves from the heavy rain, they knew they weren't going to survive on their own. They needed to seek refuge amongst the island's natives. And so they staggered onto that dirt trail, not knowing what awaited them. Miraculously, they were received by the locals with open arms. The pair was given food to eat, a thatched roof to sleep under, and even a personal assistant. A man named Corey Corey helped Herman adjust to the strange but leisurely life in the valley. One of Corey Corey's duties was to carry Melville, who had injured his leg during his escape, through the jungle on his back wherever he went. In fact, Melville was treated so well that he worried that the typee might be fattening him up for the kill. Not to worry, they told him. He would not be eaten. That was a fate reserved for the wicked members of the Hapar tribe during times of war. Melville would spend 3 weeks living among the typee before leaving the valley to return to the seafaring life on another whaling ship. While he may have taken a few liberties in turning his adventure into the semi-autobiographical typee, the work for which he was best known during his lifetime, there can be little doubt that his description of the typee people and their way of life is accurate. His account is corroborated by his shipmate as being truthful. What's more, his descriptions of the natives match those supplied by other explorers who had visited the Marquesas Islands. Melville described the average day in the life of the typee this way. Nothing can be more uniform and undiversified than the life of the typees. One tranquil day of ease and happiness follows another in quiet succession. The typee were not early risers, but awoke well after sunrise. First, they'd head down to the stream and bathe in the cool waters, breathing in the fresh air, frolicking for about 30 minutes or so, before heading back to the house for breakfast, which was a light affair consisting of fruit and coconuts. The residents of the house would sit around on the mats and engage in cheerful conversation as they ate. After this, pipes were lit and passed around, though each person took only a few puffs. From there, people went their own way. Some would go back to sleep, others would head out into the groves to collect fruit or bark fibers. Some of the girls would spend time adorning themselves with flowers and lathering their bodies with oils. Men could use this time to sharpen their spears or carve wooden designs. After the morning's light work, the afternoon was a time for a glorious siesta in which everyone partook. This usually lasted for about an hour and a half. Then came another round of pipe smoking before preparations for the largest meal of the day. Melville would often eat his afternoon lunch with the rest of the bachelors in a place called the tea, which was reserved for men only, the primordial version of a men's club. There, he dined on roasted pork. The tea was a right jovial place, he tells us. It did my heart well as my body, good to visit it. Secure from female intrusion, there was no restraint upon the hilarity of the warriors, who, like gentlemen of Europe after the cloth is drawn and the ladies retire, freely indulged their mirth. As evening approached, Melville would take a canoe out on the lake with a pretty young girl or bathe in the stream with others. When the sun went down, torches were lit, and the natives began chanting and storytelling. All sorts of social festivities served to while away the time, Melville writes. The young girls very often danced by the moonlight in front of their dwellings. Finally, everyone would retire to the house where they slept or dozed for a bit before waking to eat the final meal of the day, and then pass around the tobacco pipe one more time before collapsing into a deep sleep. The native strength of their constitution is in no way shown more emphatically than in the quantity of sleep they can endure, he tells us. To many of them, indeed, life is little else than an often interrupted and luxurious nap. Maasai. Joseph Lacouton is not your average Harvard graduate. Long before he strolled through those vaunted Ivy League corridors, he was known as Lamasalai, meaning Proud One, a name given to him by an elder member of his Maasai tribe, a group of nomadic cowherders who roam the African savanna. At the age of 14, Lamasalai was coming into his own, and he, along with his brother and a couple of friends, were tasked with getting the cows fed and kept away from ticks. They walked 24 miles in a single day to take their cattle herd down to the lowlands, where there was bright green grass to eat. Upon reaching this fertile land, they set up camp, built a fire, drank themselves full with milk, and told stories about the girls they liked. Now, with a fire nearly out, Lamasalai spread his cowhide on the bare soil, closed his eyes, and dozed off peacefully under the canopy of stars. He would open them again to the sound of rainfall in the middle of the night. Strange, he thought. It had been a perfectly clear night when he went to sleep, and while it was cloudy now, there was only a faint hint of a drizzle. No, the sound he was hearing was not rain. The cows were peeing. All of them. There is only one thing that can make cows this frightened. Lions. He got up, eyes still trying to adjust to the pitch-black night. The sound of a roaring lion shattered the night air. Chaos ensued. The cows started running, blindly bumping into each other, and Lamassoulaye as well. He could barely see, and was armed only with a small club, useless against the most ferocious predator in all of Africa. Yet he and his friends heard the menacing roar and ran towards the lion. Cows are the lifeblood of the Maasai tribe, so they must be saved at all cost. But the wheezing sound of desperation coming from a cow being taken by the throat signaled to them that it was already too late. The lions had their kill. On this night, the lions proved too clever. Two lions had attacked the cattle herd, but not together. One had circled around to the south side of the camp, where Lamassoulaye and his friends were sleeping, while the other lion lay in wait north of the camp. With the wind blowing from south to north, the smell of the southern lion frightened the cows, and they stampeded north, right into the paws of the waiting beast. It was an ambush. The cows never had a chance. The next day, Lamassoulaye and his friends knew what had to be done. They would have to track down the lions and kill them. Otherwise, the lions would keep attacking the herd. When they awoke, they set out to find the marauding beasts, which proved easy. The lions were devouring the cow no more than 100 yards from where the boys had slept. As they approached, the female lion got up and wandered off. But the male lion, not yet sated and face still buried inside the cow, stayed. He didn't want to give up his kill. He was going to stand his ground. The giant male roared. Lamassoulaye could feel his heart thumping through his chest. The lion got up, covered in blood, and started pacing back and forth, roaring loudly, and studying the feet of the Maasai teenagers to see which one was going to attack first. It wasn't going to be Lamassoulaye. This was too dangerous for him. So he gave his spear to his older brother and ran towards the nearest cattle camp to get more help. But just as he left, he saw that the warriors from the nearest camp were already on their way, and when the lion saw the men coming, he dashed off. When the boys returned to the main camp, his friends told everyone that he had been scared of the lion. He was mocked incessantly. "Oh, look, there's Lamassoulaye. He's the one who is scared of lions. What a coward." The same way a boy in the United States might be mocked for being scared of harmless daddy long-leg spiders. To the Maasai, cows are special animals. They provide the tribe with everything they need. The Maasai have long baffled nutritionists with their diet, consisting of, in order of amount of consumption, raw milk, raw blood, and raw meat. Some Maasai villages eat a small amount of fruits and vegetables as well, though many villages do not eat any fruits or vegetables at all. If you believe standard nutritional advice, you'd think this high-fat diet would be deadly, but the Maasai suffer from almost no diseases. They don't get dental caries, they don't have high blood pressure, heart disease is almost unheard of. And despite consuming an astonishing, one might even argue insane, amount of cholesterol, their cholesterol levels are half that of the average American. Unfortunately for the Maasai, in recent years, the regional government has pressured them into a more pastoral way of life. The Maasai have added grains, especially corn maize, to their diet. This has resulted in poorer health, though they are still healthier than people living in the West. Despite the government's meddling, the Maasai have largely been able to maintain their traditional ways. They live in huts made from sticks, mud, and dung. They do not have paying jobs. Instead, They herd their cattle and live as nomads. Like the Pygmies, the Maasai are famous for their height, but for the opposite reason. The Maasai are among the tallest people on Earth, with lean and slender physiques. The Maasai also happen to be one of the few tribal communities whose happiness has been quantified by researchers. The results are astonishing. Asked to rate how satisfied they were with their lives, on a scale of 1 to 7, the average Maasai rated himself a 6.4. Fair enough, but the researchers didn't stop there. They wanted to get a feel for the emotions the Maasai experienced throughout the day. Were they more likely to experience positive emotions, such as joy, affection, and contentment, or negative emotions, such as sadness, anger, guilt, and worry? The researchers created a scale called the Perfect Happiness Scale. This measure ranged from negative 100 to positive 100. A score of 0 meant one experienced equal amounts of positive and negative emotions, and a score of 100 meant perfect happiness, the highest degree of positive emotions possible, with no negative emotions. The mean score for the Maasai was a 70, with 100% of the 127 tribe members logging a score above neutral. Not only that, but a large portion of the members claimed to have never experienced sadness or guilt, and a few claimed to have never experienced any negative emotions at all. I was so blown away when I read this study that I had to see how their happiness stacked up against a modern sample. Using a data set from a study of happiness I was conducting at San Francisco State University, I compared the Maasai to a contemporary group of Americans and Western Europeans. After translating the data onto the Perfect Happiness Scale, I found the mean score of my modern population to be 22 out of 100, with 69% of the participants reporting above neutral. If being happy is taken to mean experiencing more positive than negative emotions, then yes, more people today are happy than are unhappy. But among the Maasai studied, literally everyone was happy. The average Maasai was more than 3 times happier than modern Westerners. In fact, only 6% of the people in my study scored as high on the Perfect Happiness Scale as the average Maasai. The natural way of life is so powerful that despite having to face voracious lions and undergo ritualistic teenage genital mutilation, both boys and girls, their happiness reigns supreme over ours. Piraha. Daniel Everett was living with the Piraha tribesmen of the Amazon rainforest when a tempestuous storm came through and blew over the houses in the village. The Piraha sat and watched as their homes turned from beautiful dwellings into scattered debris, laughing the whole time. When they finished laughing, they got up and started building new homes. The Piraha laugh about everything. Everett writes in his book, Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. He adds, they laugh when they catch a lot of fish. They laugh when they catch no fish. They laugh when they're full, and they laugh when they're hungry. When they are sober, they are never demanding or rude. Since my first night among them, I have been impressed with their patience, their happiness, and their kindness. This pervasive happiness is hard to explain, though I believe that the Pirahas are so confident and secure in their ability to handle anything that their environment throws at them that they can enjoy whatever comes their way. This is not at all because their lives are easy, but because they are good at what they do. As a teenager, Everett was selling LSD outside a Jimi Hendrix concert when he met a cute girl who happened to be the daughter of missionaries, and so began his conversion to a deeply religious brand of Christianity. He ended up going to Bible college and decided that he wanted to become a missionary himself. He yearned to bring the Lord's message to people in remote parts of the world. He yearned to be their savior. And that's how he ended up far away from modern civilization in the heart of the Amazon. The task of converting the Piraha to Christianity was daunting. Many had tried and failed. Everett spent years studying, planning. First, he had to learn Portuguese so that when he got to Brazil, He could talk to the locals and get them to take him to where the Piraha lived, deep within the exotic Amazon rainforest. The tribe had very little contact with the outside world and spoke their own language, a language that no one else in the world knew how to speak. So Everett also had to learn linguistic techniques that would help him to learn a language that resembled nothing he had ever heard before. When the day he met the tribe finally came, he had to hope that they would accept him and allow him to live with them, even though he had no way to verbally communicate with them. When he got there, his first impression was that the Piraha lived like a bunch of hippies on a campout. They seemed to spend most of their time laying around, relaxing. By his reckoning, they only worked about 15 hours a week. Now, it is common for preconceptions to cloud our judgment, and Dan had gone into the Amazon with the idea that the Piraha were primitive people. But he soon came to see that the Piraha were extraordinarily adept in all the ways necessary to survive in their environment. The Piraha, he reports, can walk into the jungle naked, with no tools or weapons, and walk out 3 days later with a basket of fruits, nuts, and small game. Every man, woman, and child has detailed knowledge about the plants and animals that live near them. They are hunter-gatherers and eat a wide variety of foods and always have enough. They do not show concern about where their next meal will come from, as they have the ability to go out and get food whenever they want. They are exceptionally good fishermen, and especially adept with a bow and arrow. Everett claims that they rarely miss a target. If they are using a bow and arrow to fish, and three arrows go into the water, three dead fish come out. All this he found quite remarkable. Years passed, Everett biding his time. After living with the tribe for so long, he had gained their trust and learned their language. All the hard planning and work of the last decade led up to this moment. It was time to tell them the story of Jesus Christ. It was time to save their souls. Powerful sermons meant to convert non-believers have a certain structure. You're supposed to talk about your own weaknesses, about how Christianity saved you, about how you once were blind, but now you could see. Everett told them a story about his stepmother's suicide. This was supposed to trigger a powerful emotional response, but after telling this story, he was greeted by laughter. He was hurt and confused. "What's so funny? Why are you laughing?" he asked. "You people kill yourselves?" the Piraha replied. "We don't do that. What is this?" It was not that they were mean-spirited or had a cruel sense of humor. It was the very notion of suicide that struck them as unbelievably bizarre and outrageous. And then it dawned on Everett. He had come here to save the Piraha, but they weren't the ones who needed saving. He writes, "I realized they don't have a word for worry. They don't have any concept of depression. They don't have any schizophrenia or a lot of the mental health problems, and they treat people very well. If someone does have any sort of handicap, and the only ones I'm aware of are physical, they take very good care of them. When people get old, they feed them." Still, Everett was determined that his training should not go to waste. He was a true believer. He thought he was doing good by telling them how Jesus would want them to live. So while living with the Piraha, every once in a while, he would pepper them with inspiring anecdotes about Jesus, explaining Christian theology and morality, hoping that the Piraha would change their ways. One morning, he was sitting around drinking coffee when one of the Piraha said, "Dan, I want to talk with you. We like you. We know you live with us because the land is beautiful, and we have plenty of fish, and you don't have that in the United States. But you know we have had other people come and tell us about Jesus before. Somebody else told us about Jesus, and then the other guy came and told us about Jesus. And now you're telling us about Jesus. And we really like you, but, see, we're not Americans, and we don't want to know about Jesus. We like to drink, and we like to have a good time. And we like, you know, to have sex with many people, both women and men. So don't tell us any more about Jesus or God. We are tired of it. and then they ate him. Just kidding. Having failed with this group, Dan